Hello and welcome to another episode of Defense Uncut, the first dedicated English language Pakistani defense news commentary podcast where we unpack Pakistani military procurements, events, and issues in laser-focused detail so that you build an accurate and informative big picture. So today we're taking a slightly different track. Arslan had an urgent family emergency to attend to, so it's just Asim and I for this episode. In light of the ongoing conflict between Iran and Israel and America, we thought it would be good to overview Pakistan's nuclear program. Now, we won't be able to go through every aspect of it in this episode, but we really wanted to highlight how Pakistan built an indigenous nuclear research and development and industrial capacity on one end, and also discuss its efforts to build or secure effective delivery systems, and how ongoing regional trends may direct the nuclear program moving forward. So I have with me today Asim. So how are you, Asim?
Good. Great to be here.
Great. So let's just jump into it. So, you know, I think one thing people may not have realized, and I will go into it a bit more detail, but, and this might explain to an extent a lot of the misperception surrounding Pakistan's nuclear program, but really Pakistan had two parallel nuclear programs running at the same time. Like one was, you know, the very well-known, publicized KRL project, which is the uranium side of the equation. And the other was the PAC-led plutonium side. So now the thing was that a lot of the, you know, discussion about the ISI, subterfuge, and all this kind of stuff really was tied into the KRL side. And I think that's where a lot of the perception around Pakistan having, you know, a very, I would say, like, let's say a borrowed nuclear program or an imported nuclear program sort of came from. But it really glosses over the much more structural, indigenously driven, embedded PAC program. And that was really the actual, for lack of a better word, nucleus of the Pakistani nuclear program, right? Both in terms of energy and also in terms of the weapons program, especially the weapons program in its current form today. So I just want to, before we get into our discussion, I just want to give a really quick timeline. So, you know, Pakistan's nuclear program at its infancy started in the 1950s as part of the American Atoms for Peace initiative. The whole idea, the whole hope was to leverage nuclear technology as a way to scalably drive electrification in Pakistan and provide, you know, the country with a clean, low-cost source of energy, basically. And through that, in 1956, the Pakistan Atomic Energy Commission, PAEC, was born. It's the official scientific body in terms of nuclear R&D within Pakistan. And from there, they basically carried on, you know, a series of projects under the Atoms for Peace initiative. So the big one, the first one, was the PARR-1 or PAR-1 research reactor, which was set up with American help. And then following that, in 1972, the Karachi Nuclear Power Plant, or CANUP initiative, which was built with Canadian assistance, at least in the starting half of the initiative. And, you know, really a lot of that work from the 1950s until about the early 1970s was primarily about research and development for nuclear energy and scientific knowledge. And this is a really important point to stress, was that for the first potentially 20 years of Pakistan's, you know, actual nuclear R&D, the attention and energy literally went into building a research and development base. So this wasn't a situation where this was a country which was sitting on nothing, decided to go and randomly pursue nuclear weapons for whatever reason. No. Rather, you know, when the time to discuss nuclear weapons came, and this was mostly after 1971, there was an actual somewhat flourishing R&D base within the country already for nuclear. Like there was a, you know, a family or like a, I would say like an environment of scientists, an early ecosystem of, you know, necessary facilities and, you know, academic institutions. There were some leading experts within the field of not just the core nuclear science, but also the surrounding ecosystem of it, both from the industrial end, considering how many companies had to get involved for producing those early nuclear reactors, like the CANUP program, and also on the, just the, you know, you can say the contributing side of nuclear, like, for example, the metallurgy and all those areas. So when the leadership or the national security leadership decided to go and open the question of nuclear weapons, they already had this community within the country that they can speak to, right, Asim?
Yeah, so definitely. And to add to that point, as we know, the Pakistan of like thesis, these was very different from the Pakistan that we have today, right? So there was a large number of physicists and scientists that were trained in foreign universities that were more than happy to work in Pakistan. And they were, you know, heading and working in many of these scientific organizations. And there was a very, very large pool of talent and engineers that were getting very important experience throughout.
So from that point on, that existing community already present. In 1971, we had the war with India, which led to the cessation of East Pakistan, which is now Bangladesh. And from there, Pakistan's national security leadership basically got the awareness or sense that their existence as a country could be, you know, existentially threatened, meaning that it could be completely taken off the map. Like, there is that scenario where it could happen. And already from that point on, from within 1971 itself, perhaps was not the trigger to consider nuclear weapons, but it certainly set the urgency for looking for, you know, measures for absolute deterrence to prevent further, you know, additional Pakistani territory from going towards India or being lost. And then the real trigger for the Pakistani nuclear program was India's Smiling Buddha nuclear tests, which happened in 1974. So from that point on, the sense was, okay, like, India is evidently introducing nuclear weapons into this region. And knowing that they just literally 3 years ago worked to break up Pakistan, that there is a underlying intent to basically existentially threaten Pakistan, that there is a sense that, okay, that if they had the means to do it, that they would pursue it. Like, any opening that they have, that they would basically exploit it for that outcome. So basically, they don't respect your borders at their very core. They'll always look for this opportunity to exploit. So that was the perception of the Pakistani security leadership. And now that they see India has evidently, you know, built the groundwork for nuclear weapons, that now they're gaining that very critical strategic advantage to be able to act on those aims. Therefore, Pakistan, in order to basically provide a deterrence to that, it needed to pursue its own nuclear weapons. And that was really the actual initiation or the true beginning of Pakistan's nuclear weapons program.
Yeah. So, like I was saying, that the Pakistan of, you know, the 60s and 70s was very different from the Pakistan that we evidently see today. And one of the things that I have to commend to, like, the leadership of that time was to have the foresight to see that nuclear weapons development was a goal that the nation needed to pursue, right? Because, like, so the infamous meeting that started the development of nuclear weapons started before India's Smiling Buddha test, right? So we'll discuss this later. But to have that foresight to, you know, be able to see that that's something that you will, you know, need to safeguard the integrity of Pakistan is very important. And you can, of course, with, you know, hindsight, sitting in 2025, you can sort of see that with how Iran is dealing with its neighbors and how it's being pressured, right? And you can sort of see how much foresight the leaders of Pakistan had back in the day. And you kind of hope that that's sort of the, you know, foresight that our current security leadership will also have with issues going forward. And another thing that will, you know, that we'll also discuss here is that Zulfikar Ali Bhutto's famous line that we'll eat grass, but we'll develop nuclear weapons. That was, you know, really put into practice because Pakistan as a policy wanted to develop nuclear weapons, and it did whatever it could. It hedged its bets and it did excellent planning for that goal, right? And that sort of planning we haven't seen for a lot of things. And we wish we would see that kind of planning for a lot of things.
Yeah, you know, just a really important point on Pakistan's national security leadership in the early 70s. You know, it's not just Prime Minister Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. There was an entire cadre of people who basically saw how the so-called international community, the United States, sort of dealt with Pakistan both in 1965 and especially 1971. If you read the book Eating Grass, which basically is what we're really referencing when we talk about Pakistan's nuclear program, in that book, there's a really important line where basically the author, he discusses how Pakistan's national security leadership at the time essentially came to a understanding or conclusion that, and this is his words, that international institutions and alliances were capricious, meaning useless. So this is such an important point to kind of, you know, drive home, that for in 1972, when Zulfikar Ali Bhutto brought in, you know, the country's top scientists and gave them the mandate to go and figure out how we can develop a nuclear deterrent, the understanding in that room was that you cannot trust anyone with your national security and integrity. That when lives are on the line, when your sovereignty is on the line, you are actually on your own. Like, no amount of international law, UN resolutions, or even alliances, maybe with the exception of one potential one, which was China at the time, but let's put that to the side, and that's like its own separate discussion. But in general, you could not depend on anyone when things got hot. And not only that, you cannot even depend on people or the word of other countries, especially those who are in some way trying to impede on your national interests, either as brazenly and directly as India could be, or is actually, or to an extent America, which doesn't really want you to interfere with, you know, or maybe doesn't want you to disrupt India's growth trajectory, right? So you can never trust these other powers at any point. And this is such an important, I think, lesson that our national leaders may have unlearned based on their statements today. And it's something that we need to readopt as a country, is that when you look at India threatening your water flows through the Indus Water Treaty, for example, right? Or you look at the way other countries might commit to you in terms of, you know, OIC resolutions or UN resolutions, you know, and, or for example, you have leaders in Pakistan saying that, you know, we should go and litigate India's violation of the Indus Water Treaty through international law. These sorts of perspectives, according to our own doctrine that we developed 50 years ago, need to be put to the side. Because the ones in that room in 1972, they did not say, well, if India develops nuclear weapons, we're going to go and litigate it because this is against nuclear proliferation treaties and blah, 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 right? No, everyone should sign the NPT. We believe everyone should sign the non-nuclear proliferation treaty. No, this was not the approach they took. The approach they took was, if India gets this capability, we're going to match it, right? And I think this is such an important point because, you know, if India, and, you know, straight up, they said they'll never go back to the Indus Water Treaty. That's over for them. Then you need to develop a sense that, okay, if they're not going to do that, why are you trying to litigate it? Let's say the international community agrees with you. Let's say international law agrees with you. It doesn't mean anything, right? Like, literally, you know, in the case of what's happening in the Middle East, you had the ICC weigh in and basically put an arrest warrant out for Netanyahu. No one cares. Like, literally no one cares. So why are you the ones trying to become these global citizens when no one else cares? Where, according to our own country's own doctrine 50 years ago, again, the word was international institutions and alliances are capricious, right? Which, if you open the dictionary, basically means they're useless. And I think when you have this perspective, it drives your policy towards productive outcomes, where suddenly the economy matters, research and development matters, industry matters, because all these things tie up and tie back into the things you need to be able to build a military deterrence capability.
Yeah, that's absolutely spot on. And just to add to your point, in the 70s, UN was a much more powerful entity, right, compared to what it is today. And our leaders in the 70s were thinking that. So imagine if you teleported those people to our time, what they would think about, you know, the international order right now, right? So it really is the might of right. If there's one thing that the whole Middle East situation for the past 3 years has taught us, is that it's the might of right, right? And sorry, the right of might. And you need to have might. And you cannot have might without economic power.
Exactly. You know, there are definitely trade-offs and decisions. You know, you have to trade off certain things in order to achieve other things, for sure. Like, as we'll go into this, like, the nuclear program did require significant resources that could have gone into, like, you know, I don't know, like, civil infrastructure, fine. But the point being is that at different points in history, everyone needs to make some sort of sacrifice, right? And you can say that the Pakistani public, to a very big degree, made a sacrifice for the nuclear program because, again, it was an existential issue. So, and I know we're kind of connecting it today because to the Indus water issue, but today, water security is our nuclear issue. Today, you know, if you're Pakistan's security leadership, you have to evaluate, like, okay, who have been the ones who've benefited from Pakistan's existence up to this point? Well, it's your biggest landowners, agriculturalists, wholesalers, biggest retailers, groups who haven't traditionally paid up into the system, right? And at some point, and, you know, we call this in public policy the basically political economy, meaning that it's essentially when it comes to, and this is one aspect of it, when it comes to your national sovereignty, why does it exist? right? It exists to protect the people, yes, and it also exists to protect your entitlements as a leadership. And you have a lot of these landowners and big business owners. Well, it's time to pay up, because if the Pakistan army or military cannot defend you against India, and that includes both militarily directly, but also in terms of securing your water interests, then your economic fortunes are going to go down over the long run. Like, maybe you might not be affected by it, but your kids will, your grandkids will, and so on and so forth, right? So this is where you have to make that trade-off and sacrifice. And if you don't, then that's actually like a very dangerous question to pose, right? Because at that point, it's like, well, why are we here? Right? Why do we have this country then? Right? If you're not going to invest into it. So just to put that out there, because it's very relevant to the situation we have today, because, you know, I'm sure this will become very apparent in the subsequent podcast episode, but whenever we discuss J-35s or whatever SAM system or whatever, these things cost money, right? And that has to come from somewhere. And you know, when it comes to your average Pakistani middle-class worker, wage employee, and even industrial businesses like manufacturers, you have tapped them out, right? They cannot generate more tax income for you, right? So essentially, that weight has to be shared between a broader base of people. And we're not talking about average local, you know, Pakistani laborers and stuff. No. And we're talking about people, if you look at the tax numbers and, you know, contribution numbers, we're talking about people and entities that just, and is this a matter, it's not a moral judgment. It's just a matter of empirical mathematical fact. Like, you just, they have not paid a lot into the system. And now that time is coming. So just to throw it out there. But now just to go back into the nuclear program, we have two major paths, right? We have the plutonium path, which is led by Munir Ahmed Khan. And then we have the uranium path, which is led by Abdul Qadir Khan. So, Asim, can you give us like a high level of both of them in terms of what they're trying to achieve and why we pursued two parallel programs?
Yeah. So in terms of developing nuclear weapons, just like a fun fact, even the two bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, one of them was uranium and the other one was plutonium, right? So they're definitely like, there's two distinct paths to developing nuclear weapons. So the uranium route is the one that, you know, the international community or Israel suspects Iran is at, right? So what you do is you mine uranium ore, you turn it into gas, you run it through thousands of centrifuges for a very long time, you separate an isotope that is useful for actual fission, right? And you enrich, that's called enrichment. And then you enrich that, you know, isotope. And when we say that we're enriching, you know, the gas, we're basically increasing the concentration of the isotope that we want. And, you know, once we get up to like high 90s, we have enriched uranium that can be used inside of weapons. Okay, so regarding the plutonium route, what you do is you basically run a nuclear power plant, like powered by uranium. Now, obviously, that plant can be run by uranium that does not need to be enriched to the level needed for a weapon, right? But what you do instead is you bombard that uranium with, you know, neutrons, and that gives you plutonium, roughly speaking. I'm not a nuclear scientist, but roughly speaking, I believe that's what is done. Now, you could do this if you had a lot of nuclear power plants, or you can run a dedicated reactor whose job is not to create power for the grid, for example, just to create plutonium for a weapons group. So that's essentially the plutonium. Now, as we'll see, and as we'll discuss, Pakistan embarked on both routes. So the plutonium route was being pursued by PAEC under Munir Ahmed Khan, right? And the uranium route was pursued by KRL under AQ Khan, right? And roughly speaking, plutonium-based weapons are smaller, so you need less plutonium to create the same amount of kilotons of explosion, right, compared to uranium. But uranium devices are easier to construct in terms of the outside stuff, which includes the explosive lenses and, you know, the outer sub needed to make the fissile material go critical. So roughly speaking, the uranium route requires more investment, is a very long process, but at the end of the day, you're able to create a much more crude nuclear weapon that is larger. But with plutonium, can basically create, so you obviously need a lot of investment, but it's more high-tech investment. But your nuclear weapons are, the weapons that you end up with are much smaller and are more advanced. And as we'll discuss, Einstein eventually did go down this route because this is the higher, you know, the higher end of the technology ladder when it comes to weapons development.
Yeah, so basically when we look at the literature on Pakistan's nuclear program, essentially the plutonium program was the first program that got started. And it was basically the traditional route in the sense that we had a lot of the existing R&D for plutonium, because that's where a lot of, you know, our energy R&D had come from initially for the previous 15, 20 years. So a lot of the experts that we had on station were able to pursue that program. But due to certain factors, the big one being that as soon as India announced, or like basically India had its nuclear tests, the world basically sanctioned Pakistan. And that's like a very recurring trend in this book, Eating Grass, is where whenever India does something, it's like Pakistan, they get slapped for it, because the goal is to prevent Pakistan from achieving that capability. So India essentially in the Adams for Peace era was basically able to leverage, you know, the know-how and technologies that you can get off the commercial market and basically put that to use towards developing its nuclear weapons. Whereas as soon as Pakistan was trying to do that, then all the doors got shut on Pakistan, basically. So essentially, as a result, the plutonium program started to move very slowly. And again, you know, it's not a new issue. This has been pretty much the reality of Pakistan's nuclear program, even up to this day. The US, for example, let India into the nuclear supplier group, let India into the missile technology control regime, and let India into other frameworks, which allowed India to basically import a lot of critical technology for weapons development, whereas Pakistan is totally sanctioned and cut off from all of these things. Basically, you know, the KRL initiative was set up about 2 years after the PAC initiative on the basis that it would be that shortcut to a nuclear weapon. And I believe it materialized relatively quickly. So basically by 1978, KRL had enriched uranium for the first time, so successfully. And then by 1984, they produced weapons-grade uranium. So just to put in context, Pakistan basically had affected its nuclear weapon very, like, you know, maybe up to 13 years before the actual tests. And this was a uranium weapon, to be clear. So the plutonium program was still running in parallel. It obviously was slower. And just to your point, you know, with regards to how plutonium grade warheads are basically made, I think that was probably one of, and likely still is, one of the reasons why Pakistan has not been admitted into the nuclear supplier group, is on the grounds that there is that concern that if Pakistan was able to scalably build out its nuclear energy grid with many, many power reactors, that its ability to basically stockpile plutonium warheads would just go up exponentially. So in order to curtail that and keep it limited to basically the Khoshab breeder reactors, they basically, the US essentially cut Pakistan out of the nuclear world market, for lack of a better term, primarily from that concern. That would be the main, I would say, if you were kind of like walking back and asking why did America sanction Pakistan's nuclear program, you know, I think the common perception is the AQ Khan issue, which was very much tied to proliferation and stuff. But that, you know, that's like a pretext, in my opinion. I would say that the bigger concern was that if Pakistan had like a well-distributed, robust nuclear energy infrastructure, then that would translate into potentially, and again, just to be clear, we have to stress this, like PAC and Pakistan's, you know, nuclear architecture, they make it very clear what's civilian grade and what's for military purposes. They have taken the route of exercising extreme discipline on this, right? So there was no like plan to go and mix the two, right? Whatever is for nuclear weapons development is like the Khoshab series reactors, for example. And whereas for energy, it's different. However, you're standing from the perspective of American policymakers, that this would probably be their concern, that if in theory this nuclear infrastructure existed, then they don't want to be the ones to contribute towards Pakistan suddenly developing, you know, or producing nuclear warheads at in very high scale, essentially, because that would not just disrupt the balance in South Asia, it could disrupt the balance in like globally in theory, right? So I think that's where America was coming from, potentially. That's just my opinion, though.
Yeah, I believe that's pretty spot on. I tend to agree with that assessment.
Sweet. Now, before we get into the nuclear tests, you know, through the 1980s and through the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, there was a lot of work on the industrial side that had to kick in to make the nuclear program happen. And this is where we're sort of going to debunk that the narrative that, you know, Pakistan's nuclear program just came from China. China just provided everything. Because when you read the literature, again, a good starting point is always going to be eating grass, but then you can go even further and deeper. You can find a lot of Pakistani academics who've done the research on Pakistan's nuclear program, where they'll unpack different aspects of it in much more detail. But as a primer, eating grass is just a good starting point. But that being said, Pakistan had to develop a lot of very specific, specialized industrial infrastructure to make its nuclear program happen. And this is particularly true for the plutonium program. So, you know, basically the perception, which probably is mostly valid, is that the uranium path largely did depend on foreign inputs, right? Because it was meant by design to be the shortcut path. Like basically the way Pakistan approached its nuclear program was like, there was the part of establishing the deterrence on paper as soon as possible to basically prevent India from exploiting the deterrence gap, which was left to the uranium KRL side, right? And then there's the more long-term established deterrence in absolutes or in absolute terms, which was the plutonium side, right? So they understood that they needed to bifurcate this and they needed to split this out, right? In order to make sure that their fundamental goals were being met both in the short term and long term. And again, this really speaks to just the foresight of those national security leaders to do this, because they could have fallen into either trap. Like they could have fallen into the just get the deterrence capability out there. Once we have it established, no one will attack us. They could have just gone to the uranium side of the equation and just ended it there. Right? Or they could have gone to the opposite extreme and said, no, we need to have the best in class absolute deterrence. I mean, to put all our resources into this bucket, right? Like, It really speaks to just their both their awareness and understanding to enable that split to happen. And I think we want to like basically dampen the perception that there was a bit of a rivalry between the KRL and PAC. I don't think there was. At the end of the day, the main stakeholder for this is the national security leadership, and they had two fundamentally different goals for both of them. So I think this is really important to kick in. But yeah, in order for both the uranium program to an extent, but a lesser extent, but especially the plutonium program, Pakistan had to mobilize a lot of industrial resources to get this happening. And what this involved was basically getting both the public sector, so like, you know, state-owned enterprises like heavy machine complex, national development complex, I believe, and others, and also the private sector, like Descon Engineering, which is like, you know, one of Pakistan's, if not Pakistan's biggest construction firm, to pull together and bring in all the necessary inputs to construct the Khushab reactor indigenously. So this work was happening through the late 1980s and early 1990s. And there was some assistance from China, but again, put it into context. If Pakistan was not sanctioned by the world, right, it would have been able to go and get that critical assistance from other places. So then from that point on, just to give you a list of the things that Pakistan had to like learn how to indigenously build, these include, among many, many things, a low-scale uranium ore concentration plant, uranium extraction and refining plant, uranium metals, zirconium production, heavy water plant production, tritium production plant, which is going to be very important in relation to the plutonium program, a pilot-scale reprocessing facility, gas centrifuges and cascades, centrifuge components, and explosive lenses for implosion devices. And the list keeps going and going. And remember, like, the information that eating grass has is up to a time limit. Right. It's, I think it came out just at the cusp when Pakistan began to really transition towards the plutonium warhead stock. So at that point, we're talking about something else going on in the country, not completely different, but the list of industrial capacity for the nuclear program will have grown simply because the requirements have evolved since the time this book came out, or since the time this book was researched, rather. So yeah, and then that takes us to basically 1997, 1998, when the tests essentially happened. And that's where we are today, basically. But this is, again, the tests were done through uranium warhead designs or uranium explosives. But today, Pakistan's core nuclear mainstay capability is coming through plutonium.
Yeah, so I think we're going to go into this later as well. But just to, clarify, I think it's worth, talking about this point earlier in the podcast. It's about how China helps out Pakistan in some of its, development efforts. And the best way I like to view this as is essentially the license to reverse engineer. I think that's what China provides. China does not go out and say, here's a nuclear weapon, and you can just and here's how to make it and then go ahead and make it. That's not what China does. It's a responsible country, and if it did that, it would be in a lot of trouble with the outside world, right? So China does not definitely do that. And so even with like weapon systems or anything like that, it doesn't do that. What it does is it transfers, for example, a cruise missile to Pakistan, or a laser-guided missile to Pakistan, or a MANPAD, for example. And it tells Pakistan, you have the permission from us to reverse engineer this. And then Pakistan has the ability to, you know, take that design, and Pakistan has like a head start in developing that thing. And then it goes on to develop, you know, the ingredients needed for that system. For example, if we're talking about, let's say, a ballistic missile, right? So they might have the design, so they'll have a good starting point, but the rocket motor that goes into it and the guidance computer and everything else that'll go into it will be Pakistani. Maybe the actuators will come from China, or maybe they'll come from someone else, right? Maybe they come from Germany, right? But it will be essentially a local product. What you'll so just and just to make the point of, you know, how that applies to our nuclear program as well, China wouldn't have, you know, provided like complete designs or complete things to Pakistan. Like, it may have provided very initial, you know, jumping off points, but after that, it was primarily a local effort, right? Because what else are all of these organizations and all these people doing? And how are they able to progress and, you know, obviously diverge from Chinese systems, right? So we sort of had to be realistic about, you know, on one hand, we did have some help starting out, but we have to, you know, accept the fact that, you know, after that, it's mostly an indigenous effort, right? Okay, so since we've been talking about nuclear weapons, it's equally important to discuss how you're actually going to deliver those systems, right? And obviously, our planners were thinking about this as well. And you can sort of view this development in three phases, or I'm dividing it in three phases because it makes sense to me that way. And it only sort of makes sense to talk about the systems once the nuclear tests were done. But the development and work on them started in the mid-90s, as we'll see, right? So it was way before the actual tests. So we were thinking about how to deliver these nuclear weapons. Now, the first phase that I want to, you know, earmark is 1998 to, let's say, 2003. So when we tested the devices first, until 2003. Obviously, Pakistan wanted a delivery mechanism. And initially, the idea was we wanted ballistic missiles, right? That's the standard way to deliver nuclear weapons. But Pakistan did not have successful ballistic missile programs. So initially, just like the uranium, you know, path to nuclear weapons, which was the easier way to go about it, right? Pakistan was like, we are going to do cluster bombing using aircraft, right? So what that basically is you stick a bomb, a very large bomb onto an aircraft, and you fly it very fast, and you fly it with an attitude, by which I mean you basically pull up or do some sort of maneuver that lets you launch the bomb on an upwards trajectory initially, allowing it to fly much further than if it was just dropped conventionally, right? Now, you do lose accuracy by doing that, obviously, But since this is a nuclear weapon, accuracy doesn't matter that much. But this does tell us one important thing. Toss bombing is a low-level thing, right? So it happens at low altitude, right? So it's not something you're dropping from 30,000 feet, right? It's a maneuver that you're doing made for close air support, if you know what I mean, right? And you want your aircraft to not be caught in the blast zone of the nuclear weapon. And obviously, when you're doing toss bombing, this sort of tells you that your nuclear weapon is not a huge city killer type of nuclear weapon. This is a relatively small nuclear weapon meant for tactical use, right? So this sort of tells us what Pakistan's nuclear doctrine was even from like day one, right? Pakistan was not aiming to, you know, or at least initially aiming to destroy all of, you know, India's cities, right? Pakistan's nuclear posture was first to deploy nuclear weapons as a tactical option, right? And the employment of toss bombing points towards that fact, in my opinion, at least, right? So initially, because we didn't have a credible ballistic missile program, toss bombing on PAF aircraft was our only method of delivery of nuclear weapons. Now, in like early 90s and, you know, mid 90s, just like the nuclear weapons program, in sort of like a mirror to that, you know, approach, almost two routes of ballistic missile programs were also started in Pakistan, right? So the distinction was between a liquid fuel rocket program and a solid fuel rocket program, right? So just to quickly, you know, talk about the differences between the two. A solid rocket motor has more thrust, is more rugged, but it is not throttleable, right? So you cannot change its thrust easily, right? On the other hand, a liquid rocket motor has less thrust, right? Slightly less thrust, is less rugged, right? It has very delicate components. You need to fuel it before you launch it. But most importantly, it is throttleable. And this is important for something like a satellite launch vehicle, because that would, the mission of a satellite launch vehicle is to insert satellites into precise orbits, and you need to throttle your rocket motor for that. So we'll talk about this when I talk about our programs. But that's basically the distinction between solid and liquid rocket motors. Now, look, as you may guess, liquid rocket motors are very complex things compared to solid rocket motors, right? A solid rocket motor is just a giant metal tube with a lot of fuel in it, and you basically light a match under it, right? Roughly speaking. But a liquid rocket engine has got turbo pumps, it has got turbines, it needs to pressurize liquids, and then it has an ignition chamber, it needs an injector. There's a lot of complication in a liquid rocket motor, right? So it's a more complicated thing for a more specialized application. But like I said, Pakistan wanted to hedge its bets, so both programs were started in Pakistan. So led by TRL and based on North Korean ballistic missile technology, right? This was basically the AWDY program, right? This was started at TRL. And the first test was in 1998, but this didn't enter into Army's service until 2003 because there were a lot of issues with the missile. Because, like I said, the liquid fuel technology is a difficult thing to master. And Carol wasn't really, designed to pursue a ballistic missile program. They were primarily developing nuclear weapons. And then they took up this task to develop the delivery system in terms of a liquid-fueled ballistic missile as well, right? So maybe in hindsight, that wasn't the best organization to pursue that program. Now, in parallel, in basically the same time frame, a solid rocket-based ballistic missile program was also started. This was led by various organizations that eventually became NASSCOM and Sovarko. Basically, Sovarko was tasked with the development of the solid rocket motor for these missiles, which is kind of ironic because Sovarko is supposed to be Pakistan's space agency, right? So you would think that they would be the ones developing satellite launch vehicles. So they would be given the liquid fuel program, right? But in a weird case of mismanagement, the solid rocket motor program was given to Sparkle instead of the liquid one. And the liquid one was given to Carol, which was not an organization that was geared particularly well to develop a ballistic missile, right? So this consortium of NASSCOM is, or the organization that would eventually become NASSCOM later, and Sovarko developed a series of missiles that, again, as I said earlier, started with some help from China, right? So, like I said, China probably gave you some early designs or one or two examples of something, and then gave the license to reverse engineer those. And then Pakistani scientists and organizations would build on these and develop their own systems. And anyone, who examines these missiles from the pictures that are released can easily recognize, improvements, iterations, and design changes going on these. So they're really, it's very disingenuous to say, that Pakistan's solid motor program is just the Chinese M11, right? It's really not. So a series of solid rocket based ballistic missiles were developed. Abdali was a Soparco-led program, and then Ghaznavi and Shaheen were led by NDC, which eventually merged into NASSCOM. Now, one more thing that I want to say is in the early 2000s, Shaheen 2 was also tested, but this was primarily an attempt to increase the range of Pakistan's ballistic missiles. But this was a very large ballistic missile, and it is my opinion, we don't have numbers on this, but it's my opinion that we have very, or Pakistan chose to produce small numbers of ballistic missiles like Shaheen 2, right? Because primarily it's the medium range ballistic missiles like Shaheen, Ghaznavi, and Abdali that are going to form the bulk of Pakistan's ballistic missile delivery ecosystem, right? And that's one of the reasons is A, that's cheaper, and two, like I said, Pakistan's nuclear posture is about attacking Indian military formations and not hitting everywhere in India. That's, I believe that's a secondary goal of Pakistan's nuclear doctrine that comes into effect with the development of systems like Shaheen 2 and Shaheen 3 and eventually Abwaabi, right? Okay, what else? Okay. Now that we've talked about ballistic missiles during the period from 2003 to 2010, There was another development of, systems during the same time period, and that's regarding cruise missiles. So Pakistan primarily developed two cruise missiles, right? There, one was Babur, which was a ground launch cruise missile, and the other was Rod, which was an air launch cruise missile. And both of these were meant for obviously nuclear delivery missions. Now, there's a very popular story that the Babur is based off tomahawks that, fell in Balochistan when the USA was trying to target Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, right? I personally, I don't think that's a very realistic story. And I know even Nawaz Sharif, seemed to say that it was true at one point, but I don't think that's true because what really makes a cruise missile is the turbojet or the turbofan and the guidance computer, right? And those are not things you can reverse engineer from, I call it, crash systems. What Babur is more likely based on is turbojets from China and Ukraine and indigenous guidance computers, right? And that program is safely in the realm of, possibility for the for development inside Pakistan, right? So you don't we don't need to, undersell Pakistani organizations by saying, oh, they couldn't have developed a cruise missile if tomahawks hadn't landed in Balochistan, right? I feel that's a very, naive assessment of things. And once Pakistan had developed Babur, right, focus also shifted to developing an air-launched nuclear delivery system, right? Remember, up until now, the only air-launched thing that Pakistan could do was toss bombing nuclear weapons. So when Rod was developed, that gave Pakistan the ability to deploy nuclear weapons from aircraft at standoff ranges, right? So this could be a development of, bigger nuclear weapons, right? Because this could be used in at standoff ranges, so it could be a bigger nuclear weapon instead of a tactical nuclear weapon. And also it's giving, Pakistani planners, like in a war scenario, more options. Now, one thing that, is peculiar about Pakistan's cruise missiles, Babur and Rod, is their very small range compared to, let's say, Tomahawk or something, right? Or Scalp or something. And I believe that's that goes down to two factors. One of them is turbojet or turbofan technology, right? We're probably not able to procure the kinds of turbojets and turbofans that are powering cruise missiles like Tomahawk, right? Those are extremely fuel efficient. We probably have very inefficient turbojet designs, right? And because these have a nuclear role, they have large payloads, right? There's only so much you can miniaturize a nuclear weapon, right? So those two factors probably limit the range of these systems, right?
I would say in relation to the range limits, I think they are starting to make some substantive improvements to that. So, for example, the Rod 2 has a stated range of about 550 to 600 kilometers, which does bring it from, at least according to the MBDA spec sheets, within the territory of both the Scalp and the KAPD 350. So that's one aspect. And the other is we've seen basically designs of weapons like the Rasoob 250 and the Azov 81LR, which may suggest that they have begun to experiment with more complex, like, flight control, concepts and stuff. I mean, I think overall the issue might not even be that they can't necessarily get good or better engines. I mean, they can buy those from Chinese suppliers, and they're also developing one in-house. I think the main one is really industrial scalability, which we discussed way back, and it's basically the real bottleneck in Pakistan when it comes to conventional munitions production. Most of that production capacity is pretty much run by state-owned enterprises, especially under, you know, strategic plans divisions and ESCOM and stuff. Because for them, it's like every time they have to scale up production, it's like adding more and more overhead to what they have. And there's that risk, well, like how many are we going to produce that we need to like set up all this infrastructure for? So I think that's one of those areas where if you had the private sector or you were more open to the private sector, they could take up more of that responsibility and help, you know, help you scale up production much more efficiently. And then you could focus more on the R&D side of it. But I think the designs themselves are beginning to advance quite a bit. Even like the export grade Taimur, which is basically the export version of the Ra'ad, you know, it's range limited for export purposes. You know, it has a stated range of about 280, 290 kilometers. So I think they have probably, at least from a design standpoint, have overcome that issue. Maybe it's more of like, can they get into production and induct it in numbers and get that capability and scale? It's a question.
Yeah, that's absolutely the right question to ask, right? So can we produce these in numbers? So when we were probably importing the turbojets for these systems, production rates were likely very low, right? And as we know, there are a lot of local programs for these turbofans and turbojets. And as these improve, of course, you know, the ranges for these sort of systems would improve. One more fact to keep in mind is that Pakistan only has a limited number of nuclear weapons. So it only needs, or should I say, it only has the capacity to induct a certain number of delivery systems, right? So if Pakistan has, let's generously say, 200 nuclear weapons of different kinds, it can only induct maybe like 20 rods, 30 bombers, 100 Shahin 1s, Shahin 2s, 20 Shahin 3s. And I don't know if my math added up to 200, but my point is there's only a certain number of delivery systems that you need for your limited nuclear stockpile, right? So that might be a factor that's, riding against industrialization, because you don't actually need a lot of these systems. But you do need these systems for the conventional role, which is something, you know, that I will talk about in the next phase, which is like, which I like to call the final phase, right? So that I like to define from 2010 to the present time, right? So in that time frame, Pakistan really miniaturized its warheads. And that is evident by the development and, you know, announcement of the Nasser system, right? Atak-9 Nasser system. And that's a tactical ballistic missile with a very short range. And it's a small missile that is nuclear capable and that almost certainly has a plutonium-based warhead. I mean, it definitely does not have a uranium-based warhead, right? And that points to sort of the final in my opinion, the final development of Pakistan's nuclear weapons program and sort of Pakistan's nuclear weapons delivery program as well. Another test that happened, you know, was the Bauer 3, which was an attempt at acquiring a second strike capability for cheap, right? So you launched a Bauer cruise missile from the torpedo tube of a conventional submarine. Now, this is just my opinion, but we haven't heard of any more tests of that system, and I suspect that interest in that system has been and when I say that this is sort of the final phase of Pakistan's nuclear development, I don't mean Pakistan's nuclear weapons program is, you know, stagnating or something like that. What I mean is I believe Pakistan feels at this point that whatever it needed to do in terms of the nuclear sphere, it has achieved. And now it is much more important for Pakistan to focus on the conventional side of things, right? So this is evident from the fact that we're taking a lot of the systems that we developed for the strategic sphere, like Ra'ad cruise missile, right? Ra'ad 2 became Taimur, right? Now, Taimur is a conventional version of the nuclear capable air launch cruise missile, right? And then we saw the development of the FATA series of systems, right? FATA 1, FATA 2, and these are exclusively conventional systems, right? These are ballistic missiles, and FATA 2 has a very long range, right? But it is importantly a conventional system. And a lot of this probably has to do with the fact that, you know, the conflicts that Pakistan and India have been having now are based on the understanding that we've developed, nuclear weapons to a level where nuclear conflict is basically not going to happen. And now we're going to battle it out in the conventional sphere. And in that sphere, Pakistan is developing, you know, versions of systems, that it earlier developed for, you know, strategic use. So that's why we are seeing a lot of systems with no mention of nuclear delivery. Maybe that's one of the reasons we've not seen, you know, tests of systems like Babur 3 from, you know, a submarine or, you know, the Nasser or anything like that. The most tests that we see are either you use the trials of like systems like Shaheen 1 or Shaheen 2, right? Maybe one or two trials of the Hori, but because that's not a primary system, that's, you know, preferred for nuclear delivery, I don't believe there's many of those systems left. And more focuses, you know, on systems that are like FATA and FATA 2.
Yeah, I think one thing it'd be really interesting to explore is that, especially with the miniaturization of the warheads and also the production of boosters like tritium or tritium, that maybe part of Pakistan's strategic doctrine is sort of, I wouldn't say shifted, but maybe has reached that original intent from the very beginning. When we go back to your TOS bombing example, was to have this very tactically focused nuclear program. So the whole, you know, Pakistan's approach was never to develop something that could be a city killer. It was really about maintaining, you know, small warheads that could be used against military targets, right? Especially those ingressing within Pakistan and trying to take away its strategic integrity, like territory and stuff. So maybe perhaps there was a shift towards being or having a more responsive capability. So for example, when you think about like the Shaheen series or the Lori series or the Ghaznavi series, it's like you're thinking about these massive TELs that have to be deployed somewhere. They're pretty big targets. I mean, you know, there are probably a lot of ISR attention going into them. Whereas when you have something like, and maybe the Rad and Babur programs maybe kicked off the rationale for it, was that if you have these much smaller delivery vehicles, which could be produced at potentially higher numbers because they're relatively simpler to make compared to like a Shaheen 2, for example, or Shaheen 1A even, you know, you have like, even for example, they recently tested the Abdali weapon system, the new Abdali, which seems like it's the FATA 3 that was suddenly given like more of that nuclear-esque designation. So I feel like there's a sense that, hey, like let's leverage these smaller, nimbler, more responsive weapons that we can embed within our conventional systems or conventional arsenals better for our nuclear deterrence. So that makes our deterrence much more distributed, much more federated, much harder to pin down and neutralize at any one point. That even if, let's say, someone was to go out and claim, well, the Shaheen 2s have been disabled, that doesn't mean anything. Because you have now these smaller munitions, which can also hit long ranges, like, you know, the Rad can go 600 kilometers. Who knows, like the FATA series could be developed further and further and further. I think it's like a newer rocket technology or solid propulsion technology stack compared to what was developed for the Shaheen series as well. So, you know, because they're smaller missiles, but like they're meant to be, you know, more compact and more modular in a sense. Well, perhaps the thinking is that by deploying these smaller munitions and warheads to these, you know, more efficient delivery vehicles, they were able to scale out the nuclear presence much more rapidly as a means to further reinforce that, not just that they have the ability to strike with nuclear, but that it's much more difficult to neutralize it, perhaps, because it's just that much more responsive now.
Yeah, and funny you should mention Abdali, right? Because the recent test of air quotes, Abdali was very interesting, right? Because this was not the Abdali that was traditionally known to be the Abdali system. And this goes back to what I was saying about Pakistan, you know, moving on from, you know, some of the nuclear weapons programs for delivery systems and then onto conventional systems. But this is an incident of, you know, the conventional part feeding back into the nuclear sphere, right? Because I believe the messaging here is that the Abdali system is purely nuclear, right? And the Fatah systems are conventional, right? So when Pakistan tests this new Abdali system that has, you know, a range of 450 kilometers and looks nothing like the original Abdali, this is basically the Fatah program or the advances that were made in the Fatah program feeding into the nuclear program, right? So Pakistan would replace those Abdalis with this new Abdali that's actually a product of the Fatah program, right? So the conventional sphere or the developments in the conventional sphere will also feed back into the nuclear sphere as well.
And just one point in regards to the Babur 3. I mean, it's very interesting you mentioned that, you know, after that initial test, there were no additional ones. Because my perception of even the Pakistan Navy's ongoing submarine plans, especially with the Hungor class at this moment, is that they really want to leverage the Hungor class as, you know, a conventional platform. Like, they want to use this submarine for the role it was specifically designed for, right? Which was anti-ship, anti-submarine warfare. They're not looking at it as a potential land attack platform because they understand that, you know, number one, the Chinese, they designed this for a very specific set of roles, which is conventional in nature and meant to really help you with your anti-access, anti-deterrence posture. But the other side is that a realization that when it comes to ultimately deploying a nuclear capability at sea, you need a specially designed platform at some level to do it correctly, right? You can't just bolt it into a conventional sub the way it is as it is now and expect it to work efficiently, safely, because there's a safety component. Like, now, you know, when we're talking about nuclear warheads, we're talking about nuclear warheads underwater, right? Under pressure, under a lot of, you know, a potentially higher failure situation. So it's a lot of caveats that have to go into that equation before you can just freely deploy it. So, you know, there was an interview a while back with some retired Navy admirals where they discussed that there are two options towards deploying a nuclear weapon at sea. One is you have, obviously, and we'll discuss this later, with whether Pakistan can do it, is a dedicated nuclear-powered submarine, which would ostensibly be a larger platform and be able to carry it. And the other is the quote-unquote hybrid approach, which is where you basically take the large frame of a nuclear submarine with its bells and whistles, for lack of a better term. So with, let's say, vertical launch systems, and let's say that it's large enough, like 3,000 to 4,000 tons in displacement, so that it can comfortably carry a nuclear payload, but that the power system is basically conventional, right? That would be the hybrid solution. And that would basically be like the way the Navy would effect a dedicated second strike capability. Like, I think what they figured out was that just bolting the Babur 3 into an Augusta or into a Hungor is probably not a good idea, simply because those platforms were not designed for this kind of role to begin with. You're basically taking a very good or credible conventional design and kind of taking it out of the equation for the deterrence role, because there's so many processes that have to be put into being able to use a submarine for the deterrence role. Like, suddenly it has to get integrated into your, you know, national command authority structure, and there are a lot of safeguards that have to be implemented. And there's, again, we're talking about on the field deployable safety and risks that go into deploying a nuclear weapon underwater, and just a whole list of issues that you just don't want to deal with. And it'd be better just to say, okay, when it comes to second strike, we have a very specific platform program, and it's going to be platform X. It's over here to the left. It's completely isolated from our other programs, and that's where it's all going to go into. And I think that's where the Navy's probably thought about it and is probably heading in the long term. And I think this goes into our next section, where we have to understand that Pakistan's nuclear program, it has two critical things that are generally lacking in a lot of other sectors in Pakistan. The first is you have a actual existing R&D base on one hand, and then an industrial ecosystem that'll shift the designs into real-world applications, such as reactors, on the other hand. And if that, if everyone thought that these entities were not doing anything, then there'd be no need to sanction and control and prevent Pakistan from accessing high-tech instrumentation equipment, high-tech, you know, wind tunnel testing, and other inputs that you need in order to develop systems. Clearly, there is a base that's developing things, that they're able to absorb development technology and use it productively. That's the reason why America is sanctioning them and preventing them from accessing things. Like, just towards the end of last year, we had a whole, like, series of both Pakistani and third-party Belarusian and Chinese companies get sanctioned by America specifically for providing these sorts of inputs. Like, it wasn't because they were providing rockets or anything to Pakistan. No, it was because we're providing tooling, instrumentation equipment, lab testing equipment, manufacturing equipment to enable entities like NDC, NESCOM, and so on to go and develop and produce these systems. So clearly there is a developmental ecosystem in Pakistan and both, and also an industrial one. The issue is that, you know, it's just because it lacks access to so many things that it's very easy to pass a perception that it's just getting it from China. But I think we have to put, as you said, put the, even the Chinese connection into context. What China is doing is basically giving a Pakistan the market to access things that it cannot get anywhere else because it's just simply not allowed to. That is the maximum approximation of China's role in this. It's not going to go out of its way and give Pakistan like IP and everything. Rather, it'll say, look, if you need certain tooling equipment, we can potentially provide it, but it'll be at a high markup and that company is going to get sanctioned by America. So that's the end of that. So there's a high cost to these things, basically. And the other point we have to stress is that, look, when we keep, you know, when we're saying that Pakistan has an indigenous R&D base, we're not saying, and it's very important not to conflate the two, we're not saying Pakistan is at the cutting edge, the bleeding edge of technology. We're not saying that. This is a very important point to pass. Countries could be at varying stages of R&D. Just because one is behind in R&D compared to another, like in the case of Pakistan, India, does not mean that the one that's behind has no R&D. Right? That's a very weird fallacy to make. Like, you can have countries that are behind. Like today you have Russia, which is arguably behind the Chinese in aircraft development, and fighter manufacturing. It doesn't mean Russia lacks the means entirely, like as if it suddenly just disappears because China went ahead. Right? It's not how this works. Rather, it's that some countries are behind on the curve for different reasons, which we discussed earlier. And Pakistan is in that behind in the curve, but it still has that domestic R&D base. So just to give some examples of what stops Pakistan from expanding on this R&D base. So for example, you know, we discussed the factor of US sanctions, but just another one is that a few years ago, PAC scientists, they went out and said basically that more indigenous reactor designs are doable, including for energy. But it requires a lot of time and lots of funding. So for example, there was a proposal by PAAC a few years ago to design and build small modular reactors for the rural areas. So to basically rapidly distribute and expand the country's electricity availability. Now, when PAAC, who are, again, a community of scientists, basically, make such proposals, it does so from a position of real strength and expertise. Because these are people who have scientific careers on the line, right? They want to show that they can do some amazing things. So being able to be, you know, being part of a civilian SMR project would be a big gain. So when they make these proposals, it's coming from a sincere and objective place, right? Unfortunately, Pakistan has certain constraints. Number one, it cannot import uranium easily, right? Besides from China. Because again, it's not part of the nuclear suppliers group. So you can have all this SMR technology all over the place, but you can't fuel them with anything, right? Because your own indigenous uranium ores are basically very low in scale and quantity. The other part of it is that it's an issue of funding, right? There are trade-offs that have to be made. Like, you don't have the funding available. And this goes way back to our earlier point about, you know, more people paying up into the system. But you don't have the money available in the fiscal exchequer to go and invest in these sorts of things. Because remember, the nuclear weapons program was an existential issue, right? SMR technology is cool. It's cutting edge, potentially. And, you know, it would be great to have, but it's not tying into the national security calculus at this time, especially now, given that India recently attacked Pakistan, basically through military means. So when you come from this perspective, then yeah, you are basically, you're not going to see a lot of those high-tech cutting-edge programs get supported in Pakistan simply because of the reality on the ground. But it doesn't mean that the base doesn't exist. Rather, it's a lack of a better word. It might sound harsh, but it's stunted, right? It's limited. Put a ceiling over it simply due to just the reality on the ground, basically.
Another point that I wanted to make was when we talk about this proposal where PAAC wanted to make SMRs, right? This points to a certain feature of Pakistan that we've sort of talked about earlier as well, which is we lack the industrial base in the civilian sector. But importantly, that industrial base, albeit limited, actually does exist for these strategic organizations, right? So because it was an existential project for Pakistan, we did develop a lot of industrial inputs that were needed for these programs. And when PAAC is making these proposals, it's essentially saying, hey, we have this, you know, latent or, you know, idle industrial capacity sitting around that we can put to good use if you just let us do it. So this points towards a bigger problem, right? That we do have industry, but it's very stunted and it's only restricted to the use of these strategic organizations. So maybe some of, you know, our security planners could think about easing the security controls on these industries, allowing them to, you know, provide inputs to the civilian sphere. That would definitely help out Pakistan's, you know, industrial deficiency.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, there are those rare moments when what PAC might know from a civilian standpoint could potentially align with an emerging strategic need. So, in the previous episode, Arslan and I, we sort of touched on the topic of nuclear-powered submarines. And again, look, just to be clear from the bases we're speaking on, look, we've established that Pakistan does have an R&D base that's capable of carrying out the research, design, development, and production of a nuclear reactor for a submarine. We're not saying it's going to be cutting edge and it'll happen overnight. Again, this is going to be, if it's initiated, it would be like a multi-decade program. So yeah, you could see a scenario where the first theoretical nuclear powered boat could come out as, you know, in 2045. And even then it probably won't be war ready because it'll have to be a test bed to continue developing the technology. And then it'll be a couple decades after that before the production ready design comes. But the point being is that the ingredients, both from the R&D standpoint and the industrial standpoint, they do exist to be able to pursue this. The reason why it hasn't been pursued is because, well, it's an issue of trade-offs, right? A lot of investment had gone into ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and then also the Air Force's needs, and all these paid off in different ways. And now regional dynamics are again shifting, where perhaps Pakistan's national security leadership, one would hope, is looking at what's happening in Iran, and that might suddenly, like, you know, lead to the development of a nuclear submarine. And we know the Pakistan Navy has been, like, going on and off about it. Like, it's been an on and off issue for at least since the early 2000s. That's when the first talk of it happened. And we've seen Pakistan Navy officials kind of mention the nuclear capability offhand at different points. And also, it would be a secretive program, to be frank, because it's both a nuclear and a submarine. So you have two secretive wings of the military combining to make an even more secret project. So it wouldn't be known to us until it's close to coming out, if it exists. But that being said, again, you know, the ecosystem for it is there. And now there might be that alignment that, hey, the AC comes back and says, hey, we do have the ability to make a potential nuclear submarine reactor based on this SMR research that we've been doing. And then the strategic side will say, okay, well, let's look at that and let's explore, and we can give you the funding for it. Again, a lot of ifs have to align in order for that to happen, but who knows, maybe current regional dynamics are pushing Pakistan more towards that. But again, like, just point being is that when that alignment happens, you will start seeing movement. But the macro point is that it's been a resource issue, and the resource issue does significantly, but not entirely, because Pakistan does have some natural constraints. It is an energy importer, for example, so you can never really out-negotiate that. You have to deal with that. But many of the resource problems do come from, for lack of a better term, bad policymaking. It's not due to a lack of skilled people, capacity, or even initial funding support, because that was all there in 1974 to bring the nuclear weapons program to happen, right? It's just that, you know, when you have, and the most brazen example I can think of is a sudden break between the thinking that went into the nuclear program to what we're seeing, how leaders are dealing with the water issue. When you see that kind of break, it makes you wonder, like, are you not following your own reference material? This is like, we're not introducing anything new here. Again, Pakistan's national security leadership in 1974 came to the conclusion that they needed the nuclear weapon because they couldn't trust international law or anything. And now you go and try to litigate the Indus Water Treaty. So it doesn't make sense. You're breaking your own rules, right? Which means that it's hard to take your policymaking seriously.
Yeah. So, and to add to that point, I sort of see that maybe there's some realization of what you're saying regarding the Indus Water Treaty because of some of the statements that, you know, Bilal Bhutto has been making recently, right?
Ironically, maybe, right?
Yeah. Maybe that's an indication of, you know, a realization of the seriousness of the matter.
Maybe he opened his grandfather's books and came to the conclusion everyone else did at the time. But yeah, the reality is that it's an he represents a very important constituency, which goes back to the whole political economy side of the equation. He represents agriculturalists and landowners to an extent, a big extent. And if he is facing, you know, if he says this, he's facing some heat from his constituents, right? And we're not talking about voters. We're talking about like powerful people who are saying like, hey, our crops are going to be affected. You need to figure something out. You're in the government, or you were in the government. You have an ear with these people. You have an ear with the generals. You need to like drive some urgency. So yeah, that could potentially, you know, again, drive different, you know, that original thinking back. Other things, there's some other factors as well in relation to the nuclear reactor research. You have, for example, Turkey. They're interested in developing or procuring their own nuclear submarine. You know, I think on this matter, Turkey's experience might not be too different from Pakistan's experience in that they're going to have trouble finding willing partners who will be willing to part with that technology. I mean, France is not going to do it, right? The UK might to an extent, but again, like to what degree are they willing to offer that? So that could potentially open up a, you know, an area of mutual collaboration where the funding and the support and the direction could come from Turkey to help drive a PAC reactor program. So again, and then this goes to another point, and I want to also emphasize this. I think we as Pakistanis, we've sort of coached ourselves into limiting ourselves by not being ambitious, by not seeking to push the boundaries of how the world works and not exert ourselves as a country in pursuing our interests. So, you know, just to be clear, like it's not about fantasizing and having big dreams. No, it's about, you know, when you see certain opportunities, like let's say, you know, with Turkey or wanting a nuclear powered submarine, you as a decision maker in Pakistan should push towards that and say, hey, look, we have an actual existing R&D base, right? It goes back 70 years, right? We have people who've been doing theoretical research and stuff on reactor technology. We lack money and we lack access to uranium. You get us these two things or even one of these things, and then we can help you out, right? And we can be that very trusting partner towards you because, you know, that, you know, our success in this area depends on your success. So, you know, we're interested in the confiner too. So let's work out a deal here, right? I think that's the kind of approach you have to take. I mean, it sounds a bit Trumpian when you say, let's work out a deal. But really, that's what the powerful independent countries do. They really do push the boundaries and see what they can get away with. When there's a little bit of burn, they walk it back a little bit. It's really disconcerting that you have with Pakistani decision makers by default walking the, you know, we really believe in international law and we're going to litigate this kind of line. This is not the way countries operate, right? Countries operate based on actual interests. And when those interests, you know, clash with international law or whatever, they don't really care. No one cares. And India doesn't care. So why do you care? That's where the self-limiting came in. We need to unlearn that, I would say. So basically to conclude, Asim, based on the whole macro point, which is basically that Pakistan does have an existing nuclear R&D base and also an existing industrial base. What would be some takeaways that you would probably want Pakistani decision makers to hear in relation to this moving forward?
I guess the primary thing would be to allow access to the industrial backbone that a lot of these strategic organizations have. Allow the private sector to access that industry. Because Pakistan has a lot of hidden industry that is very high tech, but it's hidden from the private sector because it's under this blanket of security. So that's one thing that, you know, Pakistani organizations need to do. The other thing is, and maybe we're moving in this direction anyway. So PARCO needs to focus on a liquid fuel rocket program, right? If they want to be a serious, space agency, they need to develop their own satellite launch vehicles. Sure, solid rockets have a place in any space program, but you need to master liquid fuel rocket engines. And maybe whatever work was done at TRL can support or help kickstart the work at, you know, that I'm proposing to be done at Savarco. And with regards to, you know, what the Navy is envisioning with regards to focusing on conventional warfighting capability, I think that's very important as well. I think it's Pakistan's assessment that it needs to focus on conventional responses and conventional systems is absolutely correct, because as we've seen in, you know, recent couple of flare-ups with India, it was the conventional systems that came into play. Pakistan needs to focus on those, and it needs to focus on the ability to produce them on an industrial scale, right? Because Pakistan's industry was or is focused on primarily strategic systems, and it needs to refocus on conventional systems.
I agree. And I definitely agree with the notion of opening up to the private sector. I think, you know, it's one of those areas where it is grossly underappreciated for the role it plays in the country, even now. If you were to basically just look up, you know, which industries or which entities pay up the biggest proportion of Pakistan's, you know, tax revenue today, it's primarily from either middle-class income earners from the cities, right? Or laborers or manufacturers. So it's the three critical sectors of the economy that drive or help drive human development and exports. The two things you need in order to be able to fund your security requirements. And those are the three that are incredibly stressed, right? By having to support so much of the weight without support from the other sectors of the economy and, you know, political economy, so to speak. And it's very important that to understand that, you know, when it comes to manufacturing in particular, and, you know, we can look at India as an example, especially in the South, is that once you allow this to operate more freely, both from a security standpoint, obviously you can put, you can establish security controls and export controls and these sorts of regulations to help ensure that things stay within the correct bounds, right? Like America does this. You don't need to have like overbearing security measures and to the extent we just clamp down on all activity, which is the case in Pakistan. You can have measured controls to, I mean, the measured controls are working against Pakistan, and America's export controls are working against Pakistan right now. So, I mean, clearly it's doable. But I think when you open up the private sector towards manufacturing, you create a lot of positive effects. Number one, you basically give the industries that are able to generate, maybe now less so compared to a few decades ago, thanks to things like automation and robotic processes, but still, you're able to generate high value jobs. And you do produce a lot of engineers and scientists in the country who don't have a lot of opportunities at home. Like once they graduate, you know, they're either looking to study overseas or work overseas. So you can finally provide these people, and they're produced in maybe not relatively high numbers, but obviously like in overall real numerical terms, it sounds like, you know, they're dedicated institutions to producing them, like Qaid-e Azam University, you know, NUST and all these other places. So clearly there are people, quite a few people who are out there who can enter the industry and be absorbed, right? So the private sector could be enabled to do that. And once it absorbs these people, then you create these ecosystem effects where once those people get those jobs and they set up families and they have requirements for housing and what have you, and then you have a whole pyramid of economic activity starting to happen from that top all the way down, which helps broaden things like your tax base, right? It helps drive up your human development more. It helps create a sense of buy-in and investment in the country amongst the people themselves, right? And obviously, there's, you know, you can't strategically, you're not able to concentrate all your industries in the eastern side of the country, right? Like that's like probably a bad idea from a strategic standpoint. So when you encourage proper private sector investment from a well-organized standpoint, from a strategic standpoint, you would do it within places like Balochistan or KP, which are your more unstable and somewhat, you know, alienated areas. So then suddenly those areas start getting a injection of high value domestic investment and jobs, and they start getting integrated economically through infrastructure, power, and other measures which are designed for actual tangible outcomes like defense. Because defense, like, let's be frank, the threat environment demands that Pakistan should spend a high amount of money in its defense needs through perpetuity, for example, potentially. That makes you the biggest customer in the block. So there's no reason why there is no proper industry to help sustain that domestically. Because what ends up happening is that if your domestic private sector is not benefiting from this, then 9 out of 10, some other country's private sector is. And that's a very important point to understand, that if your companies aren't benefiting, then some other foreign companies like the Chinese companies or European or whatever, they will ultimately benefit. So what was the point, right? And I think that's the perception and sense that Pakistan's national security leadership needs to now adopt, is to basically tie defense and security to economy and basically bring in a wider pool of people and experts from different areas to start discussing and directing national security, because you need those multiple viewpoints and perspectives and skills and resources to be able to succeed.
Yeah, and I just want to say that all of what, you know, Bilal just said is the reason you need policy people.
Yes, hire me. I have a public policy degree. No, just joking. But anyways, once again, I thank our listeners. I hope we were able to provide some valuable insights to you to be able to think about and discuss. And once again, we welcome any questions, but please direct your questions to the email that we have. That's where we're basically going to check, because it's very hard for us to look across all the platforms we posted in and try to like collect as many questions as we can. So please do email us at podcast@kuwa.org. The email will be in the description as well. Thank you once again, and take care, and bye.